Well, welcome to the Show Me History Show. This is brought to you by myself, Dave, Jim Paisley, and Bill Mulder. We're coming from Dam Radio Tuesday night. Give you a little Missouri perspective on history. And towards the end of the show, if you want to call in, you can reach us at 573-746-8020.
And starting off like this, you know how this session is going to go.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, I try to give you guys a warning, and you guys just don't listen to me.
Yeah, I got a little echo going here.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, Mr. Moppin was trying to quiet us down.
Oh, I know.
Well, I had to start up the thing. Let's see.
Old man Moppin.
Oh, I know.
Well, so you're talking into it? What's that one?
Okay. Testing.
I don't know why it's not working. We got an extra mic? How about this one? Can you guys switch them over?
Yeah. I think Jim's going to be concerned because he really likes that pink one.
How's that? That's much better.
Yeah, I can hear myself. That's actually three. I don't know what one that is.
I don't know. Yeah. Technology at its best. This is what happened when you have three old men.
They mixed up all the microphones.
Messing with technology.
Somebody messed us up.
That's it.
All right, so you guys good?
Then you wouldn't take much.
No, it wouldn't at all, you know.
All right, so tonight we're going to talk a little bit. I'm probably going to do some talking about the history of the Missouri regiments that were brought into Confederate service during the Civil War. There were Union regiments?
No.
Somebody else can talk about those. I'm not talking about those.
It was just my, you know. I mean, there's only one group we need to talk about tonight. I mean, did you see my shirt tonight?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Dress for success.
Yes. So, Jim, I'll describe this because this is not a medium that's great for looking at things, but it's Quantrill Raiders shirt. There you go.
Yep. Virginia cigars, Colt revolvers, and Missouri sour mash.
There you go.
Words to live by, folks. All right.
And that goes back to me talking about sweet tea moonshine.
There you go. See? Yeah. You can't get it out of us. So I'm going to kick us off tonight.
All right, Jim.
Since you guys are the experts on all these guys. But you know me, I like to kind of give a little history ahead of time. And so we've been doing the story of Missouri in the Civil War, and we talked about martial law, and we talked about Governor Claiborne Fox Jackson and Frank Blair and the Missouri massacre, you know, and in St. Louis. And so I thought it might be kind of fun to start off and talk about who these boys are that we're talking about tonight, okay? And if you'll remember correctly, in Missouri, we decided to secede from the Union. Now, it's going to take a little bit, but right off the bat, we elected this governor who said we owe it to our southern brethren to defend the South, all right, and join up with the Confederacy. Now, that's kind of tough because St. Louis was primarily a German population, and they were all Union, okay? And back then, you hear them talk about the Dutch. Well, the word for German is D-E-U-T-C-H, Deutsch. Somebody pronounced it here. Some people pronounce it, but we referred to them as the Dutch, okay? So when you hear about somebody being Dutchy, they're acting like a German, okay? So the Missouri boys.
Whatever that might be.
Well, yeah, I'm not going any further than that. I'll leave that to you. Now, what happens is that the governor goes down to St. Louis with Sterling Price, who was a former governor, and they try to negotiate with the Union troops that are there. And the commander of the Union troops, General Frank Lyon,
Nathaniel.
Yeah, he and Frank Blair decide, you know, this is the way it's going to be. We're going to have our troops here, and you're going to put up with it.
I mean, their concern is that the Jefferson Barracks arsenal is like one of the largest arsenals
exactly.
in the Confederacy. It's got like something like 40,000 rifled
right.
muskets.
Well, and it's important to keep Missouri in the Union because of strategically where we're at with our rivers and control of the Mississippi and all. Well, what happens is this Nathaniel Lyon, this general for the Union, tells our governor that bottom line is, if I have to kill every man, woman, and child in Missouri, I'm going to do it to keep us in the Union. And with that, he said, this means war. You can escort these two gentlemen across our lines. So the governor and the former governor, Sterling Price, they hopped on a train and headed to Jeff City. Now, when they head to Jeff City, they stop long enough to blow up the railroad bridge over the Gasconade and the Osage Rivers to keep anybody from pursuing them, and they come to Jeff City. Now, what they had done is they had called for volunteers to come and fight for Missouri. All right? Now, the first thing I got to tell you is Jeff City at the time had 3,000 people total. All right? Think of it as being like Eldon, okay? And when he called for volunteers, when the governor did, 11,000 Missouri boys showed up. 11,000. Now think about that. 11,000 guys show up in a town of 3,000. And these boys, they're ready to go. Now they're bringing every kind of weapon you can imagine. Shotguns and just whatever they had. Squirrel guns. That was it. They aren't armed. They are not part of the Confederacy.
Right. I mean, that's the distinction to make here. These guys are joining the Missouri State Guard.
Correct. Yes, exactly.
So, and they're mad.
And they're mad as hell. Yeah. So basically what happens is that these guys volunteered as the State Guard to help defend the state from the Union forces that are occupying it. Now, it's interesting in that Sterling Price, a former governor, he gets named as the commander in chief of the state militia. Basically, Claiborne Fox Jackson, our governor, knew that this guy had a background in the military, so he makes him the commander of the militia. Now, these are the same guys we talked about that wound up with the little battle up there at Boonville and wound up down at Wilson's Creek, so on and so forth. Now, the state legislature had fled Jeff City, and they all fled south, and they actually passed a secession act October 31st of 1861. So the war is in its infancy, and we turn around and step down. Okay, we said we're out. And in this legislation, I did a little digging and found it, and it basically said, the United States has wantonly violated the compact originally made said government and the state of Missouri by invading with hostile armies the soil of the state, attacking and making prisoners the militia while legally assembled under state laws, forcibly occupying the state capital, and attempting through the instrumentality of domestic traitors to usurp the government of Missouri, seizing and destroying private property, and murdering with fiendish malignancy peaceable citizens, men, women, and children, together with other acts of atrocity. So bottom line is, you know, they're telling the Union, you are the clowns that came in here. You fired on our people in St. Louis. You raided our capital. You attacked us in Boonville. And that's it. We're done with you. So on November the 28th of 1861, Missouri seceded from the Union. Now, we had kind of a handful of our legislators down in Neosho, Missouri, and that's where they met and decided to secede. So
Jim and I will always remember that city because we got that question wrong on a quiz bowl competition.
Yes, we did.
2 years ago.
Yes.
And we were super mad at each other.
We had a great debate, and we were both wrong. So basically, what happened was is that Missouri becomes the 12th Confederate state, okay? Now, here's some interesting tidbits for you. These poor saps that are in this Missouri Guard, okay? Bear in mind, they're not Confederate yet. They're just
volunteers. Yeah, we're going to talk about how they transition.
Yes. These guys got paid $39 a year. Yeehaw, right? Now, I found some other interesting information here. They got $39 a year. If you brought a horse, the horse got 40 cents a day. Now, figure that out. A horse got $146 a year, and you got $39. So I think you're kind of cannon fodder here.
Well, and let's put it in perspective. That was Confederate money.
Well, yeah,
that's true.
There you go, right? So basically what happens here, you got a government that's in exile, so nobody's getting paid anyhow. So these boys have taken up arms and off they go. Now, in November 25th of that same year, Price told his men that the Confederate government would receive into service as many troops from Missouri as my volunteer as might volunteer to serve 12 months. Volunteers were to be organized in conformance with the regulations of the Confederate Army, with the understanding that they would remain under the immediate command of Major General Price. So we've led you up to the point where these guys have been fighting in Missouri, but now they're pretty well out of the state. They're in northern Arkansas, and they basically are in a situation, so what do we do now? Well, they're like Bill said, they're mad as hell, and they're not just going to walk away. So basically, the Confederacy is giving these boys the option of, say, okay, rather than being a state guard anymore, we'll put you into the regular Confederate military, and we'll let you stay under your commander, Sterling Price. Now, bear in mind, Missouri at the time was under martial law, so you have no rights at all. So these guys that are fighting, their families are living under an iron fist, okay? They have no constitutional rights. They have no courts. They're in a world of hurt. Now, basically, Price at this time has roughly 7,000 to 8,000 men. But again, these are just militia men with squirrel guns or whatever.
Yeah, and a significant, I think about 1,000 of them are unarmed.
Right. Yeah, 1,000 of them don't have any guns at all. All right. Now, most of these guys were young men who, you know, we've talked about Missouri being the jumping off point. These guys had driven teams across the plains. They'd fought against Indians. They survived all the hardships of frontier life. So these are not, couch potatoes. These guys are some kind of rough and tumble. All right. They're frontiersmen, basically. Now, here's the key thing I want to get to before we hand it off to you guys with some of the battles. They were not fighting for slavery. They were not fighting for slavery. I can't emphasize this enough. Most of the time when you hear them talking about these Missouri brigades, they're talking about the Patriot Army of Missouri. That's what they called them. Now, a few of them were veterans of the Mexican-American War. And they were picked as officers by Price to kind of take the first positions, okay, to try and get things organized, because these guys never been in the military. And on December the 9th, 1861, Colonel Henry Little was placed in charge of the 1st and 2nd Missouri Brigades, and I'll let you guys talk a little bit more about them in a minute. Now, these two brigades would fight in 13 major battles. Think about that. 13 major battles, that's unheard of, okay? During the next 4 years, they're going to fight in Arkansas, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and Tennessee after they'd already been fighting in Missouri. So these guys are going to see a lot of action. You don't hear much about them, but there they are. Now, what drove these guys was their strong feeling of allegiance to their state. Now, this is hard for us to grasp today. Back then, if somebody asked you where you were from, you didn't say, I'm a U.S. citizen. You said, you would, first thing that came out of your mouth is, I'm a Missouri citizen, or I'm a Kentucky citizen, or I'm a Tennessee citizen. That's the way that it worked back then. So these guys believed that their national citizenship came to them through their citizenship in their state first, and the federal government second. Okay, there was a whole different hierarchy, okay? So when their state seceded from the Union, they lost national citizenship. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and to not go along with their state basically would make them either traitors or men without a country. And even Robert E. Lee himself, you know, when they offered him a job to take over the Union military, he said, I can't turn my back on my country, which was his state, okay? So there was a whole different mindset at that point in time, okay? And so as we talk about these guys and we start realizing, you know, that these are our ancestors, and they are fighting because they felt that the state had been invaded by the federal government. Think about it. They'd come in, they'd had the St. Louis Massacre. They'd had these guys declare martial law. I mean, and again, these guys are out of the state now, and they're faced with having to fight to gain control of Missouri back and free their families. That's where they were at. And so at that point, I'm going to turn you guys loose and let us Let's talk about some of the great things these guys did.
The Missouri Brigade was known as the best brigade in the Western Theater, hands down.
Yeah.
And, I mean, goodness gracious, there are a variety of people. We talk about the German settlements and the German people being maybe more Union. There was a lot of Germans, a lot of Deutsch within the 1st Brigade.
Yeah.
And, again, you said that you hit it, and it needs to be hit again and again. Understand, back then, the federal government didn't mean a lot.
No.
But the state government, if you're a Missourian, you're a Missourian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's going to, when we talk about these regiments, and it ties right in with what you're saying, the states were primary. Nowadays we have like the 2nd Armored Division and we have the 116th Infantry Brigade, and that's not how these units are raised. When Lincoln or Jeff Davis wanted regiments raised, they would turn to the states and tell the states to raise volunteer regiments. And these regiments would be known as the 1st Missouri, the 2nd Missouri, the 13th Tennessee, the 14th Illinois. You know, every regiment was named, with some exceptions, was named after the states. There were a couple, there was a couple Confederate infantry regiments that were tried to be raised, but they were eventually dissolved. And on the Union side, you might see a couple regiments that are U.S. infantry. But generally, these were all raised by the states. So everyone in the regiment was from Missouri, in the 1st Missouri. All their replacements would come from Missouri, not from other states. I mean, there might be some small exceptions. And that regiment was kind of like the building block militarily for everything that happened in the war. It was the... Basically, a colonel could raise a regiment, would get permission, and he could become a colonel by successfully raising this regiment. And then you would get the honor of riding on a horse and getting shot off that horse when the enemy shot too high.
Target.
Yeah, that was the big advantage.
Well, and you know, the thing is, again, is that these guys, like we've talked about in our history of the West and our previous history on the Civil War, these guys, we are the West at this point. Missouri is a jumping-off point. Railroads only went as far as Tipton at the time.
Yeah, and most of these regiments that are going to be raised, they did not exist before the start of the war.
No.
So while you had some small U.S. forces, Union Army was around, these regiments are being raised out of whole cloth from just volunteers that are walking in off the street.
These guys are poor farmers and ranchers, tradesmen. They're not, you know, every time you talk about the South, oh, it's all the rich plantation owners. Wrong again.
Yeah, only 1 in 10 Missourians actually owned slaves.
Yes. And you know what the largest population of slaves was in Missouri, where it was?
I'm sure it was by the Missouri River up in Little Dixie.
Cole County.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. And most of the slaves there didn't work plantations or anything. They were domestic servants for the legislature.
That's funny.
So
we got these regiments. They're about, you could get them as big as 1,400, 1,500 men. They'd be about, you know, they'd be made up of companies. Companies would have officers, too, that they elected. And then I'd just like to explain it because sometimes we take this stuff for granted and people who listen don't necessarily know a lot about the military. So you have the regiments. And then your regiments form brigades. So when we're talking about the Missouri Brigade, a Missouri Brigade would probably be between 4 to 6 regiments, could be smaller, could be bigger. And then brigades would usually be led by a brigadier general, and that's why he was called a brigadier general. They weren't always available to command brigades, so you might have a colonel doing it instead. And then those brigades would form divisions, and then divisions would eventually form into corps, and that's how. But we're going to be mostly talking about regiments and regiments in as how they relate to the Missouri Brigade. But I just mention it because sometimes I skip over that because I just assume you'll get halfway through and then someone will say, what's a regiment?
Right.
You know, and you're like, oh, I should have started a little bit lower than that. The other thing that's interesting is the Missouri raised quite a few batteries, artillery batteries, and the artillery batteries are usually named after the guy who commands them. So it'll be like Gibo's battery or Landis's battery, or they won't call them like the 1st Missouri battery. Now, the Union batteries sometimes were called that.
Yeah.
They might be like Battery H, 2nd U.S. Artillery or something like
that. Well, and here again, you know, with the confusion, this I always struggle with this in my classes because we had situations where Missouri Union troops were fighting Missouri Confederate troops. And the students would look at you like, What?
Yeah.
You know, because they were Missourians on both sides. And so
that's,
sometimes
that's going to come up, right?
It's hard to track it. Now, I do want to put one plug in here.
Oh, that's a great book.
There's a book called In Deadly Earnest. In Deadly Earnest. And it's all about the Missouri Brigade. Anything you ever wanted to know about these guys, it was written by a fellow by the name of Phil Gottschalk. Mm-hmm. Now, he passed away several years back, but I did get a chance to sit with him one time, and he provided me with a book and autographed it and told me, I mean, nobody's done more research than this guy did. He was a journalist at the Columbia Tribune in Columbia, Missouri, and this book is just beyond comprehension. I mean, he follows them through from the beginning all the way through with all sorts of great diaries and, you know, just unbelievable the information that he's got in this thing. So, again, it's called In Deadly Earnest, and it's by Phil Gottschalk. So,
yeah. And another book that I'd recommend, too, is Pete Cousins has written a very good book on Corinth and Iuka, which is are two battles that don't really get a lot of publicity.
No.
Most people assume after Shiloh, you go right to Chickamauga, and that's pretty much the war in the West. But
yeah.
Corinth is a very, very important battle.
Yeah, especially for our story, it's going to be important. Mm-hmm. Because, so it can get confusing with the batteries, especially since you might have a battery like Landis's battery, which is commanded by a guy named Wade, or like, you know, it used to be commanded by Landis. They just call it Landis. You know, so you have these things that can happen.
Historians do that. That's why the French and Indian War and the Seven Years' War are the same.
Yeah,
we do that just to confuse you on your midterms.
And we can discuss flags towards the end if anyone wants to discuss flags, because what flags these guys carried is a whole other argument and battle over when they got which flags and what their flags looked like. Because there's nothing more frustrating as an amateur historian than hearing this long story, reading this long story about how the ladies brought the flag to the regiments, and not one person talks about what the damn flag looked like.
Right.
So that's really what I care about.
Yeah.
So is this going to be like fun with flags from Big Bang Theory we're going to do?
Do you have a flag? Right. No, you know, I got to tell a story on myself. It's been years back, but I flew a Confederate flag behind my house one time.
Oh, my goodness.
And everybody raised holy hell, you know, well, Facebook, you know how that is. And so I thought, well, damn it, what am I going to do? So I took the Confederate flag down, and then I went got the actual Confederate flag, the Confederate States of America flag, raised that. Nobody said a word because nobody knew what it was.
That's right.
Was it the single star flag?
Yes, it was. Yeah, so...
So to get started, the best way to start is to start with the 1st Missouri Regiment, 1st Missouri Confederate Regiment. Now, a great trivia question for you to use at parties, for those of us who like to hang out at parties and throw around historical facts, you know who you are. The the 1st Missouri Infantry Regiment was not raised in Missouri. It was raised in Memphis, Tennessee.
Tennessee.
And we mentioned briefly, Jim had talked about the whole thing about the Camp Jackson incident. And so, just long story short, Camp Jackson was a camp set up by a bunch of militia, Missouri militia, secessionist militia, like Missouri State Guard guys. And it was close to where this arsenal that we were talking about was. And the arsenal was kind of an imposing facility, large with walls. And so they were like... They basically communicated with Jeff Davis, I think the governor had, and said, hey, we need some cannon if we're going to be able to take down this arsenal. So Lyon's concern about the guys was legitimate because a steamboat showed up and delivered two cannon to the militia, and they picked it up and took it back to Camp Jackson. So Lyon wasn't imagining that they were going to try to take out the arsenal. They were definitely going to try it. So he marched down and arrested them all. And then as he's marching them back, that's when the massacre started. People were throwing rocks. They fired back. There was all sorts of stuff. Well, interesting is that Colonel Bowen, who raised that 1st Missouri Infantry Regiment, raised it in Memphis because he had been paroled from Camp Jackson. So he set it up there, and he told all of his buddies, all the guys that had been with him at Camp Jackson, hey, come to Memphis. I'm raising a Missouri regiment here. And they all came. They had about 1,400 men show up, and they were called throughout the war the Camp Jackson Regiment, the 1st Missouri.
Awesome.
Based on that, because that was where their original origin story was from. They did recruit across the river a little bit from Missouri and some from southeast Missouri, but the vast majority of the troops and officers in that first Missouri Confederate regiment were from Camp Jackson.
They had originally been there. Had a huge number of people here in Missouri that were came here, you know, across the river and came from Kentucky and Tennessee.
And Missouri hadn't been a state for very long, so a lot of Missourians were from somewhere else.
40 years. Yeah.
So I always love talking about the West Point graduations. It's always funny when you compare the different officers and where they So Bowen did graduate from West Point. He was born in Savannah, graduated in 1853. He was 13th in his class. And in his class was General Sheridan, who finished 34th, well behind Bowen, and then old General Hood.
Really?
Do we think he did better or worse than Sheridan?
I'd say he might have done better.
He was 44th.
There you go.
I got that wrong.
Right. Yeah.
So it just goes to show how good you are in the battlefield might not be relative to how good you are in class. But yeah, so he was a graduate. In 1857, he moved to St. Louis because he wanted to be an architect, and that's where he was going to do that. And he joined the Missouri State Guard. And he wanted to, because he wanted to kind of participate and he had the military experience. They were obviously excited to get a West Pointer who was going to be part of their militia. And so.
Well, isn't this, you know, we're talking about a civil war. And it truly was. You know, there's several really good books and films that have come out talking about the graduates of West Point and the terrible dilemma they were in when the war broke out because. They literally had roommates that were fighting each other during the war.
Yeah,
I mean, they
common.
Knew the guy on the other side.
Exactly.
You know, and the other problem you have is they were all trained by the same people. So tactics sucked because whatever he did, the other guy had read the same book and knew what the countermeasure was.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of innovation, right? They'd all been to the same school.
You know, so
go for the flank. Exactly. It's always like try to go for the flank.
Exactly. Sorry.
Now, for you people that have served in the military, can you imagine fighting a battle alongside a guy? He's your battle buddy. And in the next few months, you're fighting against him.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Some of the guys I met in the military, I probably wouldn't mind taking a couple shots at them. I'm sure there's a couple of guys who'd like to take a couple shots of me, too.
No kidding.
Yeah, so it's interesting because, like, they were big. I mean, it was between 1,000 and 1,400 at times. By the time they surrendered in 1865, though, the 1st Missouri would be down to 100 men.
Wow.
So, I mean, it just shows you the wear and tear on these regiments. So the strengths can vary wildly, right? So when you say, hey, a regiment's in this battle, you really don't know. So I kind of try to go through and figure out at different times how big they were. So that's why I'll mention it, just to give people an idea. Mm-hmm. They were sent off to Columbus, Kentucky. At this point, there was kind of a stalemate over Kentucky because Kentucky had kind of said, hey, we want to be neutral. We don't want to be part of this. But whoever invades us, we're going to join the other side. You know, that's basically what they had said. Like, we want her. And the Confederates immediately started trying to move into Kentucky. And so they were stationed in Columbus and a place called Camp Beauregard. And it's near Paducah. People have been to Paducah. And then the Union immediately, when they moved in, grabbed Paducah and occupied it. And so Bowen actually eventually became a brigade commander. They put the 1st Missouri in a brigade, and it had the 1st Missouri, the 9th Arkansas, and the 10th Arkansas. So the whole brigade was about 3,500 guys. So now he's got three regiments. One is the 1st Missouri. So Bowen basically gets moved up in command to command the brigade. Someone else gets put in charge of his regiment from, you know, they promote a guy. And they had just, so they just got issued new rifles. They got overcoats, caps. I mean, this is the 1st Missouri Regiment. So they're looking good. They're excited. And, they're told they're going to go to Bowling Green. And so Bowen goes ahead and he meets his commander there, Breckinridge. And Breckinridge had run for U.S. president. Mm-hmm. Talk about how crazy this whole war had been. This guy was running for president of the United States. Now he's a general in the Confederate Army. Mm-hmm. And so he's joking with Bowen. Like, he goes, yeah, you think your 1st Missouri's pretty good. My 2nd Kentucky's pretty good at marching. I'd say let's have a contest and see which regiment is the better marcher. Like, when your boys get here, let's have a parade and we'll see But he didn't realize that the Camp Jackson guys had been drilling together for a long time because they'd been at Camp Jackson, and now they were here in Memphis drilling. And so some of the other, I think Johnston was there, and Johnston kind of warned Breckinridge, like, hey, you might want to reconsider your bet because I've seen these guys, and they're actually pretty good marchers, and I've seen them in drill. And Breckinridge was like, oh, it's fine. So they bet they were going to bet a stand of colors, basically, whoever had the best marchers. And so the First Missouri arrives. I think they got off the train, and then they're there in the town, and they had heard about this bet that was going on, so they really came marching out, and the drummers, they had like 20 drummers, and they really looked great. And so Breckinridge said to him, he said, do you expect me to back the Second Kentucky against your old regulars who deserted from Jefferson Barracks and followed you here? He goes, no, Bowen, I shan't fall into any trap. And so he just said, and so Bowen said, there's no old regulars here, General. They're there, General. That regiment's composed entirely of volunteers, and it has the best blood of Missouri in it.
Nice.
And so basically Breckinridge just said, I'll give you the colors. Like, I'm not going to embarrass my guys and have them come out and try to march.
I love it.
And so shortly after that, Fort Henry and Fort Donelson fall. And we had talked previously about how important rivers were in the West. You know, they were kind of like the highways.
Oh, they were everything.
Yeah.
That was the tactical edge right there.
And you could you could transport troops. Basically, if a Confederate city was next to a navigable river, you were in big trouble because the Union could just sail right up and land right there. And there was, and so it was like having a highway, like leading right up to your town. And that's why we see so many of these successful towns are next to these big rivers. You know, they're not in the middle of the woods up on a hill. No. You know, they're always near someplace where a steamboat can get to or something like that. So when Fort Henry and Fort Donelson fall, that's a big disaster for the South, because suddenly Nashville is accessible to the North. They can just sail right down, but they can steam right down and take Nashville. So there's this big panic, and everyone starts. Nashville was a giant industrial center for the South, and so they all these factories, and so they have to strip all this machinery out of there. Everyone's running, starting to loot. They actually brought the 1st Missouri Regiment down to keep the peace. They said, we need somebody here to maintain control over this area because it's going crazy. And so the 1st Missouri Regiment came down and basically kept the peace in Nashville while they were trying to abandon. And then eventually Forrest showed up, too, with some cavalry. And Forrest was pretty good at putting out some fires if he needed
again,
to.
You know, an army moves on its stomach, too. And bottom line is, if you've got that supply line, that was a big thing. They could offload troops and then supply them.
Yeah, well, and the big challenge is because Fort Henry, Nashville, I mean, for people who know their geography, Nashville, Tennessee, is south of Kentucky. So once you know the Union can go down that river and land in Nashville, you can't have any armies in Kentucky because they'll land there and be right behind you, and then they'll come up behind you. So basically it forced the Confederates to abandon Kentucky and fall back once. Because some people will be like, Fort Donelson was kind of like a crappy wooden fort out in the middle of the woods. What was the big deal if it falls? Well, it was guarding the river, so you couldn't steam past it.
Well, and you bring up another great point there in that again, it shows how vital Missouri was for the Union to keep it in the Union hands, because if, God forbid, the Confederacy regained control of, say, St. Louis and cut off that access for those boats heading down the river,
the whole Midwest loses access.
They're done. Yep. And, you know, as you get further into this whole thing, you realize that it was amazing, really, what Missouri, our troops were able to do. Them constantly putting the fear of God into the Union troops forced the Union to commit almost a quarter of their troops to hold Missouri. They knew that if they lost it, they could lose the war. And so you literally, at one point, they had upwards of 90,000 Union troops in Missouri who are twiddling their thumbs, but they couldn't leave.
Yeah.
They had to hold it. So that was a huge tactical issue as well.
Well, political, too. What happens if you let Missouri go?
Mm-hmm.
Now you're in big trouble with the citizenry. You're in big trouble with the people in Iowa, Kansas, because that big keystone, that big block right there, that's everything.
Mm-hmm.
If you lose St. Louis, and that's all it would have taken, if they'd have lost St. Louis, that would have allowed the Confederacy to go north up the Mississippi, and more importantly, up the Missouri and take all of that territory.
Excellent. Yeah.
So basically, we have the Confederates falling back to the south, and now Grant and other Union generals are kind of starting to maneuver against them, and we get to basically the Battle of Shiloh. This is where Albert Sidney Johnson decides, hey, I'm going to pull together all the Confederate troops I can from everywhere, and I'm going to go after Grant, and I'm going to take him out while he's separated from Buell, who's another commander with an army. And so they fight the Battle of Shiloh. Bowen's brigade was there for that. And there's more Missouri regiments, but basically I'm going to cover the first Missouri up to where they meet up with the rest of the Missourians, and then I'm going to go back and cover the other guys. So,
okay.
Because at this point, 1st Missouri is the only regiment that's fighting over in the west. They're there by themselves. So they're part of Bowen's brigade. They fight at Shiloh. They're in that initial attack, but they're in the reserve corps under Breckinridge. And then they end up getting committed, and they're on the right flank kind of that runs along the Tennessee River when Johnson. So basically, Johnson does manage to surprise Grant's command. They're in camps. They're not expecting an attack. And so Bowen's troops get in some heavy fighting at Shiloh. Their training paid off. A lot of the guys are talking about how good they were at drill, how they were able to fire and load by the numbers. At one point, they rescued a New Orleans battery that had been overrun, and they managed to go back and save it. And they lost a lot of guys. I think they out of 2,200 guys, they had 600 casualties.
Wow.
So you think, like, killed and wounded, that's like a little bit, you know, about 25%, a little bit over 25%, 30% casualties.
And a casualty back then was, in most cases,
stubbing a toe.
No, that was a... That was a death sentence in most cases, because bear in mind, they didn't have all of the antibiotics and everything we have now. The standard practice was to cut a limb off, and then they would pack it in cow manure.
Yeah.
Can you believe that? You know.
Yeah, one quote from a corporal in the 1st Missouri in this battle was, "Yesterday morning, you were feared you would never get into this battle, and I'm a damned if we ain't afeard we'll never get out of it."
And casualties also included things like desertions, missing, captured.
Yeah, they had 25 missing. So actually, the discipline was pretty good for them. I think, you know, they were a tight unit, even though they hadn't really seen combat before. I think the fact that they had drilled together and they had a lot of camaraderie probably really helped them. And that was kind of why they tried to keep the guys in the same state in the same regiment to kind of, they'd have some common bonds there.
Sure.
Also, frankly, a lot of these states didn't visit each other very much. So do you think accents are strong now from state to state?
Yeah, no kidding.
Well, and not to mention also, they're a long ways from home. So that psychological impact on the soldier.
Yeah.
I don't know where I'm at, but Billy Bob, he's lives in the next county over.
Right.
I know him.
Well, and that came up quite a bit too, because, you know, other troops could rely on supplies from their state, like the Tennessee troops might get supplies from Tennessee. Alabama units would get the states were still responsible for, like, providing uniforms.
Mm-hmm.
North Carolina would provide its own uniforms for only its North Carolina troops. Mm-hmm. Strangely, refused to provide uniforms for other states.
Right.
So the Missourians didn't get that. They didn't have a state apparatus that was really supporting them. So they had to rely solely on the Confederacy to provide for them. So it was commented several, they're almost like an orphan regiment because they were on their own.
And think, you, there you are. You're in a state that you've never been to before in your life, knowing full well that your wife and kids are back in your home state.
That's right. And these guys didn't travel. Right.
No.
I mean, if you were a merchant or a tradesman or a herder, you might go to another county or something, but there wasn't a ton of traveling that people did.
And those that did travel by like you said, by water.
Yeah.
And so to get in the interior of some of these places, they might as well have been on the face of the moon. Now, I did want to share with you, Phil Godshot's book has a great point in here in how important these guys were, our Missouri forces. They said in December of 1861, he says, there were 91,227 federal troops in Missouri. Think about that.
Yeah.
91,000 of them.
I mean, there weren't that many Union troops at Shiloh.
No. And they said it represented a fourth of the entire Union Army. So the war is breaking out, and a fourth of all the troops the Union has that could have been used in these major battles east of the Mississippi are all tied up in Missouri. Yeah. Now, that's unbelievable from a tactical standpoint. The other thing they said before, he says that before the end of the war, it's probable that at least 40,000 Missourians served in the armies of the Confederate States of America.
Yeah.
So, folks, this isn't just, you know, a little militia anymore. You're talking, you know, 40,000 Missouri boys versus 90,000 Union troops throughout this whole conflict. So it's not like, you know, you hear some people say, oh, well, yeah, Missouri is a Union state. Far from it,
right.
You know. So, yeah, it is. The numbers are staggering. And as you'll get into it with the battles, when you start talking casualties, oh, my God, the numbers are beyond comprehension.
Yeah, and this Shiloh was probably one of the, at that time, I think, was the biggest battle that had been fought so far. You know, the casualties were tremendous. Both sides were kind of shocked. Mm-hmm. It was a two-day battle, which was unusual. They hadn't had a two-day battle, I think, before this battle. And so the Confederates did really well on the first day. Johnson was killed, mortally wounded, the Confederate commander. And then that kind of like slowed down their drive. And then Grant got a bunch of reinforcements that showed up. And then the second day, the Union was basically able to drive the Confederates off the field again. And so one of the regiments, the brigade that was tasked to provide that rear guard to kind of watch it was Bowen's brigade and the 1st Missouri Regiment in there. They were kind of tasked because they had done pretty well. And so they kind of relied on them to be one of the rear guard units to protect the retreat of the Confederates. So then we can go. That was Shiloh. Now we're going to go back in time a little bit to 1861, where we're going to visit with the other regiments as they're getting formed up. And this is going to be in Osceola, mm-hmm. Missouri. And Colonel Henry Little, that you'd mentioned, he's basically raising these brigades, these Missouri brigades. He was from Baltimore, fought in the Mexican War, was stationed at Fort Smith, Arkansas. Now, interesting thing about Henry Little, when you look him up, they'll say he went to West Point. He did not go to West Point. He's one of the few officers that was direct commissioned into the Army at that time. Almost everyone went through West Point to get a commission. For some reason, he had a father who was a congressman.
And that helps probably a little bit.
Might have played into it a little.
And his father-in-law was like a colonel in the peacetime U.S. Army, which in peacetime, that's high ranking because the U.S. Army wasn't that big.
John Fremont on the Union side, yes, becoming a general.
Yeah, so we can kind of figure out how Little got his job.
If you're married to a senator's daughter, it helps.
So he's at Fort Smith. He gets transferred to St. Louis because they're like, hey, this is a problem. We need to get... First of all, Arkansas had seceded, so they're like, Arkansas is like, bye-bye, we don't want any U.S. units here, so you can go away now. So he had transferred with his family to St. Louis, and then when he got to St. Louis, he ended up resigning his commission and joining the Missouri State Guard.
That took some guts.
And they made him, I think, a colonel, and so he was, Price liked him. We're going to talk a lot about Sterling Price later, too, but Price really liked the guy, thought he was very competent, and so he put him in charge of kind of raising these Missouri Confederate troops. And, yeah, like you mentioned, they got a bounty. They got $25 every 6 months for clothing, I guess. That was something else they got. I don't know. So he was there raising them. They raised a couple batteries. The 1st Missouri Cavalry was raised. The 1st Missouri Infantry. And so, folks, some of you are saying, wait a second, Dave, you were talking about the 1st Missouri Infantry. Well, they raised the 1st Missouri Infantry, and then they get on the horn with Richmond, and Richmond says, time out. That's regiments already being formed. Too late. You can't be. So they've made the 2nd Missouri Infantry. So they had to rename them once they realized that the 1st Missouri Regiment was already formed by Bowen. And then there's the 3rd Missouri Regiment that's raised. So now you've got 2 Missouri Infantry Regiments, the 1st Missouri Cavalry, and then 2 batteries. Price basically forms these guys into the brigades. One is led by Little. That we just talked about. It's the 1st Brigade. And the other brigade is led by a guy called Slack. His last name was Slack. And he had settled in, he was from Kentucky, William Yarnell Slack, settled in Columbia, Missouri. He was a lawyer, served in the Mexican War as a volunteer captain. He ended up wounded at Wilson's Creek and was mortally wounded at Pea Ridge. So, spoiler alert.
Yeah.
He doesn't.
Didn't last
doesn't make
very
it.
Long.
No.
No.
So, and this was after Wilson's Creek. that these units were formed. The Missourians pretty much fought completely as the Missouri State Guard in Wilson's mm-hmm. Creek. Another a nice tip, I'm sure I've bothered these guys with this one too, but another tidbit for annoying cocktail conversations mm-hmm. if you want to bug people, it's actually Wilson Creek. It's not Wilson's Creek.
Correct.
Now, even on maps now, you'll look and they say it's Wilson's Creek. Nope, it was Wilson Creek. They got the name wrong.
There you go. Go figure.
So there you go.
Yeah.
See, folks, I'm a lot of fun to have around at parties.
Were you when we had that trivia night?
I dropped that one on the guy at the World War I Memorial Museum. He wasn't very impressed with
no more scotch for you.
My trivia. So these guys all march down. Then they're going to fight in the Battle of Pea Ridge.
Yeah.
So Wilson's Creek's over. Between Wilson's Creek, the Battle of Wilson's Creek, and the Battle of Pea Ridge, that's when they start forming, transferring the Missouri State Guard into the Confederate infantry.
So let me ask a question. You know, we talked about the fact that, you know, when we had Wilson's Creek, that Price tried to get McCulloch, the Confederate general, to follow him back up and capture the Capitol. And he said, I might as well go to Maine and go into central Missouri, where people, you know, he was convinced there weren't enough Confederate sympathizers. So after this, with these Missouri brigades being formed, did the Confederacy now all of a sudden welcome these guys with open arms, or was there still a certain amount of hostility between the two?
I think part of the challenge is that one was Sterling Price. Some guys did not like Sterling Price. Mm-hmm. It becomes more of an issue, I think, later on, and what we'll talk about is where some of the Missouri State Guardsmen are reluctant to join Confederate service. And in fact, even in this case, even though we formed up some Missouri regiments here, there's still a lot of units of Missouri State Guards that do not turn into Confederate units. So even at Pea Ridge, you have large units of Missouri State Guard that still fight as the Missouri State Guard.
Isn't it true that, I don't know for sure, but weren't the James boys or the Youngers maybe down there at Wilson's Creek, and they were some of those that said, no, I'm not going to join the Confederacy, but I'm going to.
Some of the Youngers were down there.
What ends up happening is once everyone gets sent west or gets sent east across the Mississippi, at some point the Confederate government puts out a policy that says, we're not going to support units anymore that are not Confederate. Okay. So you have a choice. You can either go back to Missouri or join Confederate service. And about 1,000 Missouri State Guard troops leave and go back into Missouri and fight in Arkansas.
Well, I guess it's also, you know, I think I saw a quote one time from McCulloch describing the Missouri boys, and they were, again, it's a bunch of farm kids.
Oh, yeah.
So he's, you know, here he is all spit and polish and drilling these guys, and then here comes, you know, 1,000 yahoos coming.
So they get uniforms, right? Mm-hmm. And they're all bleached white, like wool uniforms, and they smell like sheep. They smell so strongly like sheep that the other state's troops go like, bah, whenever they see the Missourians.
Way.
Yeah, they're like making fun of the Missouri troops because of the smell.
Oh my God.
From the wool.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it says it was rough white homespun wool, and it had wooden buttons.
Oh my
on their
God.
That's pretty fancy.
Yeah. That's really nice to wear too when it's 105 degrees. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and we've talked about this battle before, but yeah, we have Van Dorn shows up. Van Dorn's going to take over right before Pea Ridge. He's going to be the new Confederate commander, dashing guy, famous for having been died during the war, but died at the hands of a jealous husband who caught him in bed with his wife, right?
Yeah, so, I remember that.
So
yeah.
He did die with his boots on, though.
Well, yeah.
In Van Dorn's defense, he was not murdered in bed. He was caught in bed, and then he swore he would write the guy an apology if the guy let him go. And the guy, he didn't refuse to write the letter, so the guy went into his office and shot him at his headquarters.
God.
Are you talking about the Battle of Oak Hills?
Oh, that's right. So this is two names for this battle, Wilson's Creek or Oak Hills, right?
Here we go.
And this is a common thing in the Civil War where there'll be a Union name for a battle and a Confederate name for a battle, which again, folks, great, great trivia stuff. Just wows the ladies. Really, really impresses them. Antietam or Sharpsburg? Like you can get
right.
Go over
oh
to
my God.
Bull Run or Manassas?
That's right. Yeah. Is this going to be on the midterm?
Right. So Van Dorn's in charge. Van Dorn does that great thing we talked about where Van Dorn did not finish high in his class at West Point, was not a high achiever. His strategy always is, I'm going to march around to around the guy and get around behind him, and then I'm going to be across his line of supply. And as we mentioned last time we talked about it, no one pointed out to Van Dorn that that also means now the other army is across your line of supply. But Van Dorn never cared about that. The one thing Van Dorn does, and we're going to notice this all the time, is he was more of a cavalry guy. He did not seem to understand how to lead infantry, and he had a tendency to push the guys way too hard and march them way too far, to where by the time they got to the battlefield, they were like worn out and exhausted. And that's what we're going to see happening here at Pea Ridge, Elkhorn Tavern. Mm-hmm. There we go for Bill. And also at Corinth, same thing's going to happen. So it's like he didn't have this sense of how far he was pushing his troops and how, you know, you got to rest them a little bit. Sure. Otherwise, by the time they get there, I mean, you can get there the fastest with the mostest, but you better be ready to fight.
Yeah, he's expecting them to keep up with what the horses could do.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think he had any kind of empathy. And it's funny, when you look at Sterling Price, you're talking two sides of the exact opposites. Price was really had a lot of empathy for his troops. Probably one of his best qualities mm-hmm. was that he really cared about his soldiers and would take care of them. Mm-hmm. And they really loved Price for it. I mean, the troops could tell that he cared about them. Van Dorn, guess what? They could tell that he did not give a damn about them at all. Mm-hmm. And they did not like Van Dorn as a result. A lot mm-hmm. of them didn't like him at all. So in this battle, it's super cold. It's March 1st. I mean, it is freezing weather. Van Dorn had actually fallen into a creek on the way to the battle, so he was sick. He's riding in a wagon. Oh, so he's basically pushing these guys really hard, and he's not even walking.
He's in a wagon.
Yeah, he's
nice. Like,
so they're exhausted, they're tired, they're cold, and they fight this battle. And in the end, he kind of divides up his commands. One command gets defeated in detail because all the officers in that command get killed, and no one realizes. Everyone's like, well, I thought he was in charge. Oh, no, he's dead. Well, you were supposed to be in charge. Well, that guy's dead, too. So then they have nothing ends up happening over him. But half the army basically ends up sitting around not doing much because all the officers are killed, all the leaders. And meanwhile, Van Dorn tries to do all the fighting on his side with the Missouri State Guard, who do a good job. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, because the other half of the army has been defeated and is just sitting around, Curtis is able to concentrate most of the Union troops on Van Dorn's half of the army and fight them off, basically. Mm-hmm. So,
well, you're being very nice to Van Dorn.
Here it comes.
Well, no, hey, I'm saying he's bad.
I was wondering how long this before this came out.
He's not
Van Dorn was a horrible leader.
I'm okay.
Horrible tactician. He had no clue. He was the Custer of the Confederacy, if you will. Charge.
Yeah,
I think he was aggressive. I mean, he was better as a cavalry commander than he was as an army commander. I mean, and that's what I'm saying. He had ideas about what he wanted to do. He just wasn't great at executing the actual. And we're going to talk about other bad strategies he has. But I do want to point out one cavalry captain in the Missouri State Guard who I think has the best name of any, J. Rock Champion.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
What a great guy.
Oh, yeah.
There's a scene in the battle where the cannons are firing and there's an infantry unit that comes out from the woods and is threatening. And I think it's Gibo's battery. And so J-Rock rides up and he's like, there's infantry over there. And Gibo's like, I don't have a gun to spare to point at them. So he goes, okay, I guess we're going to do it. And he's got like 25 cavalrymen. He attacks an entire infantry regiment and drives them off.
Wow.
And just because they're shocked, they wouldn't expect anyone to come in and attack them like that. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, I think, you know, I wonder sometimes, you know, the more I'm listening to you guys, the Missouri boys were, I don't want to say they were undisciplined, but they were not as strictly disciplined as the rank and file Confederate forces. And it makes you kind of wonder when you're talking about the fact when they took out the officer corps, one of the toughest fighting units is the one that they're going to fight whether they got a good leader or not, the Missouri boys.
And that's true.
And so, you know, it was kind of interesting. You know, I was hearkening back to the American Revolution class I taught, and, you know, they always said, the first thing you do is shoot that clown on the white horse.
Yeah.
And when they dropped a British officer, you just basically paralyzed all of the British troops. And I'm wondering if that wasn't something of a, you know, you described the exact same thing here with when these Confederate generals were dropped, it left those troops arguing amongst themselves. But I can see the Missouri boys saying, I don't need that clown. I didn't like him telling me what to do anyhow.
Well, they were fortunate in that. One thing you can say about Sterling Price is it seems like he almost gets wounded in every single fight he's in, but he's a pretty big guy, and he can take – you always see him getting shot in the arm or something.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the thing you need to feel sorry about is his horse.
Oh, yeah.
Sterling Price was not a small man.
Really?
I mean, like, so I think he's always catching shrapnel. How could it miss him?
And a horse is a big target. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so he's, and you know, you're thinking here, remember I talked about they were the sheep, right? They're wearing their mm-hmm. sheep uniforms. It's also kind of easy to shoot a guy wearing a bleached oh, yeah. white uniform, especially in the evening. They said when they were attacking, it almost looked like ghosts
yeah.
moving through the woods because they were so bright.
Well, and you know, you make another great point there, you know, and it harkens back to the issue of having the flags to rally when they're shooting. They're all using this black powder. You can't see squat.
Yeah.
And the flags were used to kind of rally the units around that flag. But it's interesting. You watch some of these movies, and everybody has the perfect blue and the perfect gray uniforms. Well, if you watch the real reenactment, that Confederate side, they're wearing every color of the rainbow almost. Yeah. Everybody's got, you know, like you said, the bleach stuff, the butternut, I think they called it.
Yep.
Yeah, and so, yeah, it had to be, when the firing started, it had to be chaos trying to sort out who's a good guy and who's a bad one.
And for the record, for state pride, I just want to point out that the guys who were screwing up, none of the Missourians were over there. Price's command was all the Missourians. They were the guys doing a good job over by the Elkhorn Tavern.
Well, of course. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. And tactics. We're not that far out of the Revolutionary War.
Right.
And the generals that were in charge that had went to West Point were still working off of that old style of battle.
Yeah.
Lines, fire by rank.
Yeah, Von Steuben's manual. Yeah, yeah. Isn't that something?
Yeah, you know? And so when I talk about Van Dorn wearing these guys out, just to give you an idea, it's freezing weather. It's super cold. You know, yeah. They don't even have coats probably. They're just wearing their uniforms. And they had marched 55 miles in 3 days to get here.
Oh, my God.
And they had been up, at the time that the battle started, they had been up for 21 hours before the battle started.
Good grief.
Just marching all during the night. Because, yeah. Of course, Van Dorn's like, who cares? Just do it, you know? Like,
yeah, and they're not eating steak and potatoes along the road either.
Yeah, so by the second day, this is a second-day battle also. You know, at some point, they're like, okay, it starts getting dark the next day. The problem is their artillery's all out of ammo. So all the batteries start leaving. And Van Dorn's like, what's going on, guys? And they're like, no ammo. Like, we got to go back and get our ammo. And, of course, Van Dorn had screwed up where his ammo train was supposed to be, so they had to go all the way back there. For some reason, they'd sent all the ammo trains back to camp at the end of the day. And so the artillery basically had to leave the battlefield. And so when the battle starts again the next day, they're like, we got to retreat. They realized they couldn't. The Union was just blasting with all their guns, and so mm-hmm. the Confederates just pull out.
I'll raise my point again, Jim. Mm-hmm. He was a lousy leader.
I'm not saying he was good.
Well, and you brought up another great point there. I hate to keep interrupting, but when the battle, when it gets dark, it stops.
Well, yeah.
You know, that nobody had night vision goggles back then.
And the other point is, too, you talk to commanders that really know what they're doing, and the biggest, most important thing is logistics.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, tactics are great, but it's logistics that win the battle. Like,
right.
Where was the ammunition?
Right.
It wasn't here. So, yeah, that's so they have all their artillery has to leave because the guns are like, why stay here? We have no ammunition, so right. We have to leave now.
Right.
We have to go get our ammo.
Well, Bill, let me ask Bill a question here. You're in the process of writing your book, and maybe you ran across this. During this retreat, again, I heard that it was either the Youngers or the James boys were down there, and as they're retreating with the supply wagons, basically they figured we're done. Union forces are sweeping in from both sides, and I want to say that it was the James boys that, or the Youngers, one that swept in and held them off and allowed them to get their remainder of their supplies back and retreat. And they said later on, when the guerrillas start operating in Missouri, pretty much any time that Quantrell and the boys asked for something, they remembered that it was those guys that had come and helped them. Is that, had you heard that story?
You're right on the money, because remember, at heart, the Jameses and the Youngers, this was before they were outlaws.
Right.
They were guerrillas.
Okay.
They were under Quantrell.
Okay.
And Anderson. So, yeah, they were absolutely helping out.
Okay.
But it was not for the most aesthetic of reasons.
No, right.
It was, oh, we could use this.
Yeah.
It'll keep our cause going.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, so the commanding officer of the 3rd Missouri was killed. In this battle, shot in the abdomen. His quote was, "I wish I only."
That's not what I thought you were going to say.
I didn't mean either.
He said, "I only wish I had 100 lives that I might die again and again for Missouri."
There you go.
And then he died.
Yeah.
So.
Good man.
So they had casualties. I mean, they fought here, and even Van Dorn. I mean, if he had any good qualities, at least he was complimentary. He said he'd never seen better fighters than these Missouri troops and more gallant leaders than Price and his officers. Probably because he's like, I don't want these guys talking to Jeff Davis about how I screwed up this battle.
Because those guys were fighting. Yeah, exactly.
And so then Van Dorn's ordered, hey, move your army to Memphis. You're going to cross the Mississippi. And so they kind of march north and then start marching east to get to the Mississippi, and then they're going to try to cross over. And so they've been ordered by the Theater of the West, basically, like, you know, Johnston is not dead yet at this point. Shiloh hasn't been fought yet. And so he wants Van Dorn to get his guys over there because he wants – I mentioned he was gathering all the troops together to try to get this army to go to Grant. He was hoping Van Dorn's army was going to be part of that. It doesn't turn out that way because they have trouble getting across the Mississippi, so it delays him. But Price actually gets commissioned as a Confederate major general at this point.
Wow.
So he gets his commission.
There you go.
So now he's official. The 2nd Missouri Confederate Brigade was now disbanded, so now there's just one Missouri Brigade. They formed the 5th Missouri Infantry, so now we've got the 5th Missouri Infantry Regiment that's formed. And then Price basically puts in his recommendations to the Confederates on who he thinks should get commands, like brigade commands. One of them's Little. Green is one. You're going to hear some names that are familiar. There's a Steen. Steen's a known name out here. Parsons.
Yeah.
Parsons is recommended for major generalship.
Mosby Monroe Parsons.
And a Daniel Frost. And so now their Price's division has 4 brigades. Little's brigade has the 17th. Basically, it's a bunch of Arkansas troops and Louisiana troops. We don't need to get too much into all the different stuff. But there's a bunch of different batteries. There's like 5 different batteries. I think something like 5 or 7 batteries crossed over. And so they take the steamboat to Memphis, and they're promised as they go, you will return to Missouri. You're not going to stay in the West. You'll be allowed to return to Missouri. And so they're like, okay. They got their first Confederate pay. For 2 months, they got between $30 and $50.
Wow.
Confederate money, yes.
Yeah, but still, it's better than $39 in the militia.
And they got 54 caliber Mississippi rifles. So now finally they'd had all these scatter guns and all sorts. Now finally they're getting issued actual, like, consistent rifles.
But, okay, on that note, I was going to ask you, the technology at this stage of the war, we're still talking 1861, early 1862, the technology, are we seeing things like the Sharps rifles and those coming
not
to the
for
forefront?
These guys. Not
at this point, it's
muzzle
strictly a muzzle loading rifle that, and I guess they were rifled. They weren't smoothbore.
They're rifled.
And so.
They might have had smoothbores. I think you still might have guys who had smoothbores because they're old Mexican war supplies. But now we're seeing more rifled muskets are becoming the norm,
which is a big jump in technology.
Sure, and
huge jump.
And the mini ball they were using,
conical mini ball.
Yeah, it looks like a modern bullet. I guess, but the tactics had to remain the same because the technology hasn't advanced enough yet.
Right. I mean,
so
it's
you
still slow firing.
Still had to line up in a line.
Not as accurate. I mean, they're more accurate than the. I mean, Bill can probably talk about this a little bit more than me, but they're definitely more accurate than the smoothbores because they're rifled, right?
I've had a smoothbore and I've had a 54 caliber Mississippi, And the Mississippi done a great job.
So how far out do you think you could hit a man with a Mississippi rifle?
Mississippi, if you're doing 30 yards, you're somebody.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. That's still not that far.
No.
Okay. But that's, again, why they line up, right?
Well, yeah. It comes out of there, and it's like when you're a kid playing wiffle ball.
Yeah.
The ball, bullet go left,
we've beaten it to death, but they always shoot high, right? So the officers would tell them, aim for the legs.
Yeah. Right.
Because they know that naturally they would end up hitting center mass probably if they did that.
But it is amazing to me that when you talk about these battles, you know, if you've ever had a chance to watch one of these reenactments, like down at Wilson's Creek, the distances... You talk about some guts to stand there.
Sure.
I mean, you can literally see the whites of the other guy's eyes.
And the smoke, it's terrible.
And they're all lined up opposite each other, just blasting away.
Yeah, you didn't see smokeless gunpowder until about the 1890s.
Right. So. And there you are. You're sitting there after you fired your shot. You've got to reload that damn thing. Yeah,
pretty good. Now, the 54 Mississippian was a good rifle, but my three-band Enfield 58 caliber was head and shoulders above it.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there you go. You know, again, it's if you haven't had a chance to shoot one of those and you get a chance to go to one of these mountain men things or whatever, it's pretty cool.
It really is, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So these guys are all over there. We formed a new Missouri regiment, so now we've got a bunch of them. Now there's five Missouri regiments that are formed. Sad thing is the Missouri cavalry units, they get dismounted.
Damn.
And there's nothing that's going to really take the heart out of a cavalryman than having to become a dismounted cavalryman.
No kidding.
And so the only Missouri cavalry regiment that was remounted after this dismounting was the 2nd Missouri. They actually ended up fighting with Forrest. Mm-hmm. And another tidbit, late 1864, 65, they actually became Forrest's escort company. Mm-hmm. So they had lost enough numbers to where they were personally assigned to him as his kind of escort bodyguard unit, which if you read anything about Forrest, meant you were probably going to be in the thickest of fighting because Forrest kind of used them as like a flying squad. Like he liked being in the middle and in the thick of
very
things.
Much so. Yeah.
So it was I thought that was kind of cool. They fought with Forrest's brigades, and then they ended up being basically his right-hand men, like his personal bodyguards when the war was getting close to an end.
Yeah. Now, when we see TV shows or movies about calf units, we always think of these wonderful steeds that look and are probably thoroughbreds.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much.
Yeah.
Plow horses, draft horses, and mules. Especially mules. Mules were steady. They had better health, too.
Carry a load, too.
They carry a load, yeah.
Yeah.
So...
Well, and you know, again, when you see some of the old photographs that were taken of some of the battles, you know, what sticks in my mind is Gettysburg, along with the bodies there. It's staggering the number of horses and mules that are laying there.
Right, because they're just natural targets.
It's just a constant rotation of you know, steeds of some sort, you know, and you always hear about these cavalry and the leaders that are on horseback having horses shot out from under them. Well, of course.
Yeah.
You know, and so, yeah, that's something else. Again, and logistics, you know. Okay, so you wipe out every horse those guys have got. Now you've got all this stuff you've got to move. You've got people you've got to move.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a big, has a big impact.
And there's a very important railroad junction right in this area called Corinth. We'd mentioned the Battle of Corinth. There's actually technically two battles of Corinth. The first one is not, I don't know if you want to talk about that very much, Bill. There's really not a whole lot to it. I think the Confederates kind of fortified it. And then Halleck is sneaking up slowly, and eventually the Beauregard says, oh, man, this looks dangerous. And he basically sneaks out in the middle of the night, and Halleck captures an empty city.
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, too, because you know, we talked about all of the major... cities along the waterways.
Yeah.
But then a lot of these battles are going to take place inland, and it's at that point that, you know, the North had a tremendous rail system.
Sure.
The South had some rails, but then all of a sudden those rails that they did have, those junctions where those things came together, that became the site of some of the biggest battles of the war.
Yeah, I think some people called this railway the vertebrae of the South.
And Corinth was an important battle.
Yeah.
They needed to take that before they could go on down to Vicksburg.
Yeah. And so, like, because there's a rail line that goes all the way from Memphis, I think, to Charleston that runs through Chattanooga and goes from Memphis to Corinth and then goes over to Chattanooga. And it was, I think it was their only remaining rail line that actually went from the west to the east.
Is that the same one that's for Harper's Ferry? Do you know?
I think that's too far north.
Too far north? Because, you know, that was the thing. Harper's Ferry had had the munitions plant.
But this gave the South the ability to move supplies from the west to the east, right? Same way they could get important supplies and food from Texas and Louisiana into the, by having the Mississippi, then those supplies could be shipped all throughout the South on the rail lines.
And so now you've got another target in that, not just the boats on the river, but also the locomotives and all. And it reminded me there were two guys, their last name was Rains, and they came up with some really novel approaches to take these rails out. They created a bomb that looked like a lump of coal. And they were saboteurs, and so what they would do is they'd sneak to these rail yards at night and throw three or four of these things in the coal bin behind the locomotive. Now, it wasn't going to blow up there, but somewhere on the road, they shovel it in
there and
kerblooey.
That's a good idea.
It was pretty interesting, They had all kinds of things like that. They came up with some of the first landmines. They had landmines that they had designed, and you stepped on it, and it had just a spark like a flintlock rifle, and that would trigger,
lighted.
You know. But as the war is progressing, more and more devious things are coming to the forefront.
Torpedoes, the first torpedoes,
yeah,
right? First submarine.
Yeah.
They and it's interesting when you look at this. So when Corinth falls, and we talked about the Mississippi and how the South had kind of fortified, you put forts. I mentioned Fort Donelson, how Fort Donelson actually protected Nashville, even though it was not close to Nashville because it was at the river's mouth and it could sit there. All along the Mississippi, they've got fortifications like Island Number 10. They've got some fortifications at Memphis. So the South has these fortresses every, couple hundred miles along the Mississippi to keep the North from coming up and down and kind of securing their communications. Once Beauregard has to retreat from Corinth, then the problem is then Memphis falls because the Union, suddenly you can't defend Memphis to the west. And then Island Number 10 gets destroyed. And so as they're moving down, they're slowly also reclaiming the Mississippi because they're gaining this territory in Mississippi. And so they're basically almost doing a land approach to Vicksburg this way by coming down like that. Sterling Price decides he's going to go to Richmond. He's going to talk to Jeff Davis, and he's going to try to convince him to let the Missouri troops return to Missouri. And Jeff Davis is a character all on his own. I mean, like, he's definitely got a personality. People didn't always love him. Price shows up in Richmond, and he gets a big party for him. They throw him a big, giant party because he's this conquering hero from the West. And imagine, people don't... If you're in Richmond, the fact that people in Missouri are fighting for the Confederacy, that's so far away. Uh-huh. And here you've had this big defeat at Shiloh, but not Price. Price was the victor, right? He won at Wilson's Creek. And, just read his own PR. He'll tell you all about it, how he won the battle. And then here he was. So he's considered a real hero, and he's very impressive. I mean, to be honest, Price was one of the most popular men in Missouri. So he has this huge reputation. He's kind of a larger-than-life character. And so there's a giant party for him. And some people are saying, hey, maybe we could get rid of Jeff Davis and we could make Sterling Price the president of the Confederacy. Because Jeff Davis is a real jerk. I mean, he's like a sour, negative guy, very sarcastic, very vengeful. If you ever make it. And so Jeff Davis hears this. And he immediately doesn't like Sterling Price because he sees him as a threat.
Sure.
And so before Sterling Price even meets him, he's already on the bad list for Jeff Davis. So they go meet, and Davis basically, his opinion is, he'd had some military service. He'd served with the Mississippi Rifles in the Mexican War. He thought, Jeff Davis basically thinks he's the kind of guy who thinks he can do anybody else's job better than them.
Yeah.
And he's more than happy to give you advice if you're willing or not willing to listen. He's going to provide it to you. And so he does not feel like Price has adequate military knowledge. I mean, basically, Price wants to be put in charge of the Missourians, be able to take them back to Missouri, and then do a fight in Missouri. He doesn't want to fight in Mississippi anymore.
Before you go on, are you going to talk more about Corinth?
Yeah, we are. Not the the first battle.
The second one.
Second, okay. We're not right. at the second
All
battle
right.
yet.
When we get there.
Yeah. The that's a little ways down.
Okay.
So Jeff Davis says, well, we're more than happy, Sterling, to let you go back to Missouri. Why don't you just go back?
Oh,
and
yeah.
we'll keep the troops. And yeah. so Price gets super angry,
yeah.
threatens to resign. He tells him, I can return to Missouri and raise a new army, and I'll win new victories for the South. And Davis agrees to accept his resignation and says, quote, if you do go back to Missouri and raise another army and win victories for the South, or do it any service at all, no one will be more pleased than myself or more surprised.
Oh, my God.
What and a, so Price, you can just imagine. I'll and Jeff Davis was. Is kind of a lean, lanky guy.
Yeah.
Price is like a 260, 270,
yeah.
I think I'm being charitable,
oh, yeah.
Pound guy.
Big
he,
guy.
He pounds his fist and he says, then I will surprise you, sir, and storms out.
Wow.
And so there's a whole scene back at the hotel.
Yeah.
His adjutant rips his Confederate rank bars off his uniform and throws them on the
oh,
ground.
My God.
And of course, all the reporters that
oh,
are
yeah,
writing.
Wait.
And so the next day, cooler heads prevail.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
They think about it. Okay. So Davis tells him, okay, we will eventually transfer your Missouri troops back to Missouri. And so they kind of, gives him back his resignation. Okay, I'm not going to accept your resignation. And so what he did do, though, is Beauregard, Jeff Davis does not like Beauregard, gets rid of Beauregard, and puts Bragg in charge, Braxton Bragg.
Oh, God.
Because Jeff Davis loves Braxton Bragg.
Yeah.
Like, he thinks Braxton Bragg is probably the only other person who's liked less than Jeff Davis.
Yeah, mm-hmm. the only person that could put up with Davis.
Yeah, so...
Bingo, that's it.
Yeah.
So Price comes back all happy, and he comes and he sends Van Dorn. Jeff Davis puts Van Dorn in charge of Vicksburg. So he's like, Bragg's going to be in charge of the army, the main army. Van Dorn, you're going to be in charge of Vicksburg. And so Price comes back all happy. Hey, guys, guess what? And then Bragg tells Price, yeah, I can't spare the Missourians, so they're not going anywhere. So that's the end of that. So they're not going back to Missouri again. And so at this point, Price has two divisions. He's got his first division under Little. Mm-hmm. It's got two Missouri brigades and two other brigades, one Louisiana, one Alabama, Mississippi guys. And then we have Dabney Morey, who's got a bunch of just regular brigades. So all the brigades, the Missouri troops, are still under Little. They're in Little's division
okay.
now. And they've got some time off, so what are they doing? They're doing a lot of drilling. And Hardy, General Hardy is a famous Confederate general. He wrote, like, the infantry tactics book for the U.S. Army. And basically he told Price that he thought the Missourians were the most efficient, best drilled, and most thoroughly disciplined body of troops in Mississippi. So... Bragg was also very complimentary. So the guys are really getting a lot of compliments on how
sure.
they look, how they drill. Because you'd think, oh, these guys are all like, you know, we're talking about they're farm boys, but they're actually getting whipped into shape. I mean, they're officers. And I think having that steadying influence of the Missouri State Guardsmen, the officers and who had previous experience, it kind of helps them learn, you know. And the fact that, like you mentioned, they're alone.
Right.
They're away from their families.
Right.
It's hard to go AWOL. Like, if you live in, if you're in station in Mississippi and you're from Mississippi, it's a little bit easier to sneak out of camping. They got a river. They got the Mississippi River between them and their homes.
Well, and they said that was one of the biggest problems that Davis had was that they seceded on the premise that states were independent and they each one is independent and should be able to determine their own fate. And so they secede, and now he's turning around trying to pull all those independent states together as a union, you know, a confederacy.
Yeah.
Well, you know, he got a lot of pushback on that. They're saying, well, why in the hell would I leave Arkansas to go fight in Mississippi?
Yeah.
You know,
especially when you know what's happening to your family back home.
That's right. Know? The first purpose of this whole thing was for our independence. You know, and now you're wanting to pull us all together and put us back in the same kind of situation we were in before the war started. We'll all be united again.
Yeah, and
you've done nothing.
Yeah.
You're just looking out for yourself, and you're wanting power. And if you read some letters that people wrote back in those days, Jeff Davis wasn't highly thought of politically.
Yeah, right.
Not at all.
Yeah.
They viewed him as... a person that had a lot of ego, had a lot of vision, but the vision was to put him up as a supreme leader.
Right.
That's how he saw himself.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he definitely had issues. I don't think anybody would really like, I mean, look who his buddy was.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all you can judge a man by his friends. Oh, geez, I'm in trouble.
You are.
Yes, you are.
So Bragg signs a special order number 115. Right now it's July 1862, okay. Which basically relieves the Missouri State Guard of their commitments. And he says, you can go back to Arkansas under General Parsons. He'll take you guys back there, and then you guys can fight there. But we're not going to support Missouri troops anymore. And so I'm sure some of the guys who joined the Confederate units were like, well, but the problem is they'd already sworn an oath. Right. You know, they'd already sworn service into the Confederacy, so they can't go. So these are basically the last holdouts. It's about 1,000 guys, and they go back to Missouri as Missouri State Guards. Mm. And it was, it sounded like they still fought for Arkansas or in Arkansas. So I'm not sure if they eventually didn't join up with the bushwhacker units or just join up in the Department of the West and just fight alongside those guys. Well, I don't know.
There's another great point you make. It's at this point that we start to see, you know, little Archie Clemens and Bloody Bill Anderson.
Some of these guys maybe go back. Yeah.
Now all of a sudden, you know, that it wasn't just individuals. Each one of those guys wound up with a pretty good crowd of other guerrillas around them.
And so also you're getting guys coming back now who've seen the elephant.
Sure.
You know, they've been in combat. They're maybe gotten more than their fill.
Oh, absolutely. Right.
And so Van Dorn actually does a decent job. I know Bill's not going to like that, but he does go down and open up a little stretch of the Missouri by attacking Baton Rouge. I mean, he does the Holly Spring Raid, which I know as everyone talks about because it's like the only good thing Van Dorn ever did, but he does kind of burn all of Grant's supplies and forces Grant to retreat to the north.
He got lucky.
The sad thing happens in Bolivar.
Yeah.
J-Rock Champion gets killed.
Oh, no.
He dies there. He was some of the stuff he was doing down there was there was a Confederate belle who'd been outraged by the local Union commander, and she swore that whoever rescued her or avenged her, she might be interested in getting to know him or perhaps wedding him. So J-Rock Champion was sniffing around a little bit to see what he could get accomplished in the area.
Always the woman.
But at the Battle of Bolivar, he gets shot in the forehead and dies. So much for that.
You know, that'd make a great name for a quarterback, wouldn't it?
I love that name.
J-Rock Champion. Yeah.
Apparently, he fought at Lexington, too. I got to find out more of what he did up at Lexington.
Yeah.
So at the Battle of the Hemp Bales.
Yeah, heck yeah.
So they now form the 6th Missouri Infantry Regiment. So they're getting enough guys coming in. Some of these guys are getting paroled. From previous battles. Some guys are coming across from Missouri. So they have enough to actually form a 6th Missouri Infantry. And in mid-June, the Confederate Congress passes a law that says regiments have to be brigaded by state. So before we saw mixed, where you'd have a couple of Arkansas regiments and a Missouri regiment. I mean, what a pain in the butt for the guys running the Army, because now you've got to break up all these brigades and figure out, okay. But it was, again, a focus on the states. And the states were like, we don't want our Texas guys. Another issue was like, we don't want a Virginian leading our Texas brigade. We want a Texan leading it. So sometimes they had to move officers around so you could have the same guy from the same state leading the brigade. So,
whether he was good or not.
Yeah, right. Whether he was the best guy for the job.
Right.
But Little still has his own division under Price. So he's got 4 brigades and a bunch of artillery batteries. Price goes to Iuka. Iuka is a town that's a little bit south of Corinth. They go in there and it had been abandoned by the North. So there was like a ton of supplies. And so the guys are eating like crazy. They've got all these foods, blackberry cobbler, brandy. They're just having a big party because they've never had this kind of stuff before. You know, this is not since they were home.
Yeah.
So they're loving it. They have a big feast. And of course, the officers dine well like they always do.
Yeah.
And so Bragg is telling Price. So now you have Van Dorn over in Vicksburg along the Mississippi. You've got Price in Iuka, which is basically roughly east of Vicksburg. And then Bragg is trying he wants to go into Tennessee and fight up there. That's what Bragg's trying to do. And Bragg's technically the commander.
Okay.
Like he's in charge technically of the theater. Mm-hmm. So he tells Price, come join me in Tennessee. I want you to march your guys up here. Van Dorn tells Price, hey, no, cooperate with me. You know, I'll I want you to fight with me. We can do some stuff. I've got some great ideas. I've been sitting here in Vicksburg, and I'm coming up with a bunch of great schemes.
Oh boy!
Hanging out in this bar. I've been hanging out in this bar in Vicksburg for a while, and so Price is kind of like, I don't know who I should listen to. And Jeff Davis basically says, well, Van Dorn's senior to you, so just do whatever Van Dorn says. Never tells Bragg that. So Jeff Davis basically interferes, and so now Price is going to do what Van Dorn does. Bragg still thinks Price is coming to help him.
Oh, boy.
So,
yeah.
The problem Price has is while he's sitting in Iuka, his guys are eating. Mm-hmm. This is great. What do I do? I don't know which way to go. Meanwhile, Grant is coming down like a bat out of hell to catch him in Iuka. And Grant splits up his force, and he gets Ord with half his guys, roughly half his guys, and then he gets Rosecrans with another half, and he's going to send him around. He's like, I'm going to pin him between two forces. Mm-hmm. And folks, we've seen this in a plan a billion times by these commanders. The old, I'm going to split my guys. Mm-hmm. This was what they did at Wilson's Creek.
is
what they tried to do at Pea Ridge.
Right, yep.
And so they're going to split his forces. And so he basically tells Rosecrans, you attack from the south. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be with Ord. When we hear the battle start, we're going to be northwest. We're going to come in and fight, and we're going to outnumber Price. We're going to have him trapped.
Right.
Well, Rosecrans comes around. And so if you can imagine, they're in Iuka. And from the northwest, the top, if it's like a square around it, the top left corner, that's where Ord and Grant are waiting. And the bottom left corner, that's where Rosecrans is coming. Rosecrans sees that there's also a road that goes off to the southeast. And he's like, should I take both those roads? Well, those roads they're not necessarily connected with each other. And I don't want to divide my guys up between those two roads. So I think I'm just going to take the one on the southwest side and not the southeast side one. And I'm just going to march up that side. So he goes up. And sure enough, after a while, Price is kind of watching for Ord. He thinks he thinks Grant's going to come from the north. He doesn't know that Rosecrans is coming around from the south. Well, his scouts start telling him, hey, there's guys coming up from the southwest direction. Mm-hmm. Battle starts. He starts to realize, oh, wait a second, this is a bigger force than I thought it was. So he starts fighting Rosecrans, basically fights him to a standstill. The problem is that the problem is that they don't hear him. So the whole plan was that they were going to listen, and that's how Grant would know when to fight.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an acoustic shadow. So we've talked about it before.
Right.
I think it also happened at Wilson's Creek where they couldn't hear, Siegel couldn't hear the attack. And so Ord never hears it. And so Grant's with them. They're like, when is Rosecrans going to take? They don't realize Rosecrans is getting beat like a drum on the south side.
Yeah.
But Price, again, is nervous. He doesn't really concentrate on Rosecrans. If he concentrated all of his guys on Rosecrans, he probably could have beaten Rosecrans. Instead, it's kind of a stalemate because he's still worried if there's other Union troops out there somewhere. While he's fighting this battle, he's talking to Little there on horseback, General Little. He goes to raise his arm. Under his arm, a round flies and hits Little smack in the forehead, knocks him off. He slumps in his horse, and he's dead. Killed instantly.
Wow.
And so Price is, like, very attached to Little. This has a big impact on him.
Sure.
He's very affected by this. And so that night, they're kind of like, hey, some of his officers are coming to him, and they say, we should get out of here because Rosecrans is here. We're pretty sure Grant is – there's more guys on the other side, and I think we're going to be – and. They had this big supply train that they captured. They're like, let's get this supply train out of here, you know. And they're telling us, our scouts are telling us that southeast road, there's nobody on that road.
There you go.
So we can sneak, kind of squeak out the back if we go. And Price is so distraught about Little dying that he's they had to keep saying, "What are we going to do with Little?" Like he's crazed with grief. They keep so finally they bury him in a little garden behind the headquarters. And Father Bannon, the chaplain of the 1st Missouri Brigade from St. Louis, did the rites over the grave, and they buried him there. His promotion to Major General arrived a few days later.
Oh, my God. Of course it did. Yeah.
So, and basically, Price wanted to go to bed. He didn't want to wake up. But his officers are like, you need to, like, we need to decide. Like, we cannot start this battle again in the morning. Like, we need to get out of here. So they said, okay, he finally agrees. And at 6 a.m., they go down that little southeast road,
and they
get out. And they pass, when you look at these two roads, it passes like maybe a mile or more from the other road.
Oh, my God.
And so the whole army sneaks out the back. And then Rosecrans comes in and he's like, everyone's gone.
Where are they?
He's like, where are all the Confederates? And he realizes that and he's pissed. Grant gets there and is even more pissed.
Again, so, you know, you sit there and talk about modern warfare where you have communications.
Yeah.
You know, and this, you know, here again, how many battles do you hear about where it was just miscommunication?
Yeah.
You know, if you could have,
no communication.
Or no communication, yeah.
Yeah, so and basically Price is able to squeak around, then he moves south and just gets back over to where Van Dorn is.
It's just pretty, to me, amazing when you, again, watching the progression of militaries from the American Revolution into the Civil War and into World War One, it's not just the weaponry, it's the technology that comes with it. And look at us now with drones and everything else, you know, but it is communications, you know, just unbelievable, you know, the advances that have been made there. You know,
we don't use pigeons anymore.
No.
Well, yeah. I mean, and yeah, we're gonna wrap up soon, but just the other thing to consider is they had just started like the Signal Corps,
right?
Like the U.S. Army even, but there were Signal Corps officers, even the Confederates, and you know, they're using like flags,
yeah,
and they'll build towers, they'll climb up. They started to have like magnifying glasses, like they might climb up into a steeple and they'd
be able
to look out.
Didn't they say they started using balloons in the Civil War?
They did,
as well,
yes. Like for observation?
Yeah, good luck getting me up in that damn thing. You know, you're sitting up, talk about a sitting duck.
Well, at Gettysburg, one of the reasons that Buford could figure out how many troops he was facing when he was up against Heath's infantry and other guys, he had a Signal Corps officer with him who was in the seminary. There was a tower up there.
The cupola,
and he could climb up in there and look, and Buford was a big believer in those Signal Corps guys, and they could communicate for miles because they would set up signal towers in the mountains, and they were able to communicate back and forth between them. It was amazing.
Yeah, you can actually go up in the cupola still to this day.
Really?
And I went up there and looked from that location and went,
yeah.
Well, you can see a ways.
Yeah.
And they had like telescopes and mm-hmm. ways to.
But it, you know, again, to me, it's fascinating that the logistics and the technology, you know, they probably sit there equally as important in every one of these battles, yeah, as any of the tactics or the technology as far as weaponry goes.
Well, and even like for that point, when we talk about Gettysburg, where Longstreet is doing his march and he's going to attack the Peach Orchard, they were going deeper back there, but when they came up over a hill, they saw a signal tower on top, I think, of one of the round tops, mm-hmm. and they realized they're going to be able to see us if we come over this hill. So they had to back down and countermarch to go back. So where they really wanted to set up is not where they ended up setting up, because that one little signal tower up there, they were like, they're trying to make it a surprise attack. So yeah, they ended up coming around to more where the Peach Orchard is and those areas.
Well, and like you said earlier, you know, you run out of ammo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's over. You know, you better retreat because you haven't got anything else to throw at them.
So I think next time we could we can stop it here and we can continue with Second Corinth, which okay. is going to be a major battle for the Missourians.
All right, great.
And then Vicksburg.
Oh boy,
and we'll get into a little of that stuff next time.
Oh, that's great.
You guys got anything else? We good?
No, I think that'd be terrific.
All right. All right, folks, thanks for joining us.
And, thanks a lot, folks.
I think we'll see you in 2 weeks. Let's schedule it for next Tuesday, 2 weeks from now.
Sounds great to me.